This is iRadio's group chat. If you're talking about it,
we're talking about it
on iRadio.
Smartphones, social media and constant connection. For young people today, being online isn't just part of life, it is life. But as screen time rises, so too do concerns about its impact on mental health, attention, sleep and even how young brains develop. New research suggests many children are spending hours a day on devices, often late into the night, while more and more young people say they feel overwhelmed, distracted or even addicted to their phones. At the same time, there's growing debate about whether social media should be restricted altogether for under 16s. To help me unpack all of this, I am joined by psychotherapist and lecturer, Dr. Coleman Nochtor. Coleman, thank you so much for joining me on the show. First off, you've spent over 30 years working with young people. How would you describe the relationship between teenagers and their phones at the minute?
Yeah, well, I suppose you see it evolve over time. I would have got involved in this back in 2010-11 when the iPhone came on stream first. And back then we were just worried about kind of Facebook and YouTube. They were the kind of two things that we were worrying about at that time. And then over the last, obviously, 15 years, you've seen the advent of TikTok, Instagram, now ChatGPT and all of that sort of stuff. So it has evolved massively. And it's probably just that the phone has become so much more a fabric of our lives. We are probably seeing the first generation who have never grown up before a phone. And I suppose the worry is that what we've seen is a move from a play-based childhood to a screen-based childhood. And so what we're seeing now, maybe in those older teenagers and younger adults, is maybe the cost of that in terms of what they're finding difficult. And I mean, it's important to point out, we also had a global pandemic in the middle of that, which would be contributing to some of those issues. But COVID certainly didn't help. Whatever about how we were before in terms of technologically dependent, it seemed to take a shot in the arm and has been noticeably more dependent since. Yeah.
Talk me through some of those concerns that are presenting then, that are signaling the high dependence from, you know, that kids have grown up with now to teenager age.
I suppose from the point of view, if we think about we're seeing the first generation of young people who didn't grow up on the road, on the street or on the green, right? So what we're realizing now is the importance of those early experiences in terms of how you manage conflict, how you negotiate, how you develop autonomy, how you become an individual who makes decisions, all of those things. When they were kind of compromised, then I guess we could grow up on a screen in our room without that sort of interaction and those skills being learned. We're finding probably a lot of younger people now struggle with social communication, struggle with conflict, struggle with negotiation of, you know, even things like turn taking down as far as, helping somebody out or, you know, reading social cues. A lot of that sort of stuff is becoming more and more of a challenge for children. Again, you can't take out that for 2 years of their life, they might have been locked in a bubble at home, and that would cause difficulties as well. But I would say that, you know, two of the most fundamental skills you can learn as a human being is to listen and to tell a story. And there are two things that I think young people are really struggling to do. And again, you have young people who would find a phone call anxiety provoking because the kind of spontaneity of having to respond off the cuff rather than being able to kind of think about what you're doing. And all of those things, I think, as we prepare ourselves for adulthood, bring with it its own anxiety. And I'm not pointing a finger at young people and saying it's your fault. I just don't think we've taught them those skills. And I genuinely think that what we also are seeing is a lack of an opportunity for young people to gather in spaces without adults. I just think back to my own teenage years. 90% of it was spent sitting on a wall, just chatting, talking. You know,
yeah.
It was, we didn't have mindfulness back in the 90s because we didn't need it. You know, there was so much, you know, and I would see a lot of young people now, and I think probably boys aged between 15, 16, 17, who don't see their friends outside of school. They don't meet up for this, go to the cinema at the weekend. They don't. And, you know, when you ask them about it, they'd say, well, why don't you ask your friends over? They'll say, to do what? Like, we don't have, and there's not, we've lost that idea of just hanging out for the purposes of hanging out. And I think that's a real difficulty. There's a real loss to that. And I don't think young people have a lot of opportunity to gather in spaces. I think many of them would say if there's two or three hanging together, there's an assumption they're up to no good. And they feel that from passers-by. 90% of young lads are absolutely fine and they're not up to anything wrong, but there's still that assumption. We've seen lots of things like youth clubs and things like that that have kind of disappeared into the ether. So the only place where young people can hang out online without adult supervision is online. And we've driven them into those spaces because we don't offer an alternative. And just I'll finish on this. A lot of people would say, parents would say to me, oh, you know, my kids play sport, so that's a social. It's not. Like, I train an under 16 soccer team. The lads have 5 minutes at the start before we're getting into drills and doing this and doing that. And then they've 5 minutes walking to the car at the end. It's not a social gathering. It's a gathering of people, but there's no hanging out and shooting the breeze element to that. And so, you know, they're relying on things like Snapchat or headsets on gaming to have those conversations. And I just think they're missing out on the real face-to-face space to just be.
That social element that's so crucial that you do remember from your own childhood, the likes of sitting on walls and talking rubbish to one another.
Yeah, but that's where you got your information from. Like, my laboratory of life while I was a teenager was the 65 bus from Blessington to Temple Oak. And I just learned everything about the world on that bus from conversations with my peers. But I was getting information from probably, you know, misinformed information, a lot of it, but it was from my peers who were at a similar level to me rather than getting it from algorithms. And, you know, we've only seen recently this stuff with the Manosphere things and the Louis Theroux documentaries and stuff like that. Our role models are now determined by algorithms, not determined by our communities or where we live or who we spend our time with. And I'd much prefer to see our kind of value systems informed by our people in our communities rather than something removed as an influencer on a screen.
Yeah, who could be from another side of the world, another set of circumstances. Like, we probably don't have a whole lot in common. It can definitely skew it all. I know you've studied this particular area extensively around platforms like hooking young users. What makes platforms so addictive and how should we be aware of that?
Yeah, well, you have to understand that in Silicon Valley, they've all the best neuroscientists in the world, all the best psychologists designing the platforms to what's called persuasive technologies. So they're deliberately designed to hack your attention. So, you know, even the notifications being in red, your brain thinks there's something important that you have to check for that. Things like, even when YouTube brought out autoplay the next video, which was like, you know, you go into it shows you another thing similar to the last one. That was a game changer in terms of hijacking our attention. But the real issue is it's called a variable reward system. So you don't know what the next thing you're going to do is going to be good or bad. And that's directly taken from casinos and gambling. So a lottery ticket be a good example of, you know, when you're scratching through and you see 50 euros, and is the next one going to be 50 euros? You know, match attacks, that's a kind of a variable reward system. You could get, you know, a brilliant Messi card, or you could get something not so good. And a lot of notifications in social media is the next video going to be the one that the better one? And is it going to be, you know, so we keep scrolling for that kind of variable reward system, which makes us keep going back and back and back. The other side of it is that it's really quick hit dopamine, you know, so you're getting these kind of hits that you crave and require. And so if you're getting that hit from dopamine all the time, and then you have to go in and sit through 45 minutes of geography, it's going to be much, much more difficult because your brain is used to the quick fix of dopamine. And so when we see a lot of things like children or young people's lethargy or disinterest in school or absenteeism, all of those things could be contributed to that kind of dopamine level of technology and social media, which is kind of feeding our brains artificially. But that's the level of expectation that almost becoming bored has become something that should be avoided at all costs, when in actual fact, boredom is very good for your brain in terms of creativity, imagination, and even from the neuroscience perspective. So there's so much investment gone into making these platforms as addictive as possible, and they're bloody good at it, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Like, even what you said there about the I can relate to that feeling when you're scrolling. Like, is the next video going to be the next big thing that I'm going to really enjoy, that dopamine hit that so many people are thriving off now? But there's been growing support for restricting social media access for under 16s after it was introduced in Australia. Do you think that a ban here would be necessary in that way or effective?
I'd probably go with the effective question first. I mean, again, in Australia, there's mixed reports around people being able to bypass these things and access the platforms anyway. And what you don't want is to set a ban where you drive access underground. And so young people are checking social media and then can't alert somebody if they come across something difficult because they shouldn't have been on it in the first place. I definitely think the content moderation, you know, there's stuff on social media that 13, 14 and 15 year olds should not be seeing. And until we have some way of kind of filtering that out, then we almost have to err on the side of caution. But, you know, for me, it's not just kind of social media is one element of the technology that's risky. You know, I think smartphone ownership is a problem. You know, if you have your own smartphone, no matter what it is that you do, you can get this stuff through WhatsApp. You can get things sent to you. You can get, there's all of that sort of other avenues. So it tends to be, you know, the internet's like water to a fish. It's all over us. You know, it's everywhere we look, and we seem to try to tend to one bit while it's like tending to a corner of the garden while the jungle grows around you. I do believe the real responsibility is with the tech companies. They have to take responsibility and put something in place to make it a safer place. But there's absolutely no appetite for that. You know, if you can imagine, technology affects how you communicate, how you work, how you learn, how you feel about yourself. If there was a drug that did all of those things, imagine the amount of testing it would have to go through before it ever reached the counter of a pharmacy. Whereas this, like even ChatGPT, like it took Instagram 2 years to build up to 100 million followers. ChatGPT did it in 8 weeks. A lot of the tech companies it's an arms race for our attention. And so their sole goal is to command as much of our attention as possible. So there's no appetite on them to curtail that. You know, and if you think about the algorithm sells information about you to other companies so that you can be, you know, it's a thing called surveillance capital. So it's gathering all the information about you. So the younger they get you, the more capable they are to profile what it is you like, don't like, and that you'll be able to be kind of targeted. It goes back to the old adage, if there is no product, you are the product. And maybe that's the piece that as young people, we probably don't think about that element of not seeing that as important, you know, accepting all the cookies, sharing all that sort of stuff, because in the short term, you don't see it. But in the long term, it's absolutely going to be important in terms of your own ability to make choices.
Really interesting points you've raised there, particularly around smartphone usage being a key part of this issue. You know, like, I don't think I got a phone until I was maybe, well, I didn't get a smartphone definitely until I was 15 or 16, because they were only starting to be rolled out properly then. And, you know, it's just getting younger and younger all the time, which I can see would be a big issue. But before I let you go, Dr. Coleman, but I'm sure there are people listening this evening of all ages thinking about their own screen time and how long they spend on their own phones, kind of constantly in that cycle of the dopamine hits and things like that. What would be some realistic changes they could make every day to their phone usage to improve things for themselves?
I think expanding your phone free time, you know, so it's not about I'm going to reduce my phone usage by this, I'm going to increase my non-phone usage by this. So having kind of more sacred spaces in the day that you don't allow the phone into your life in that way. But it really comes down to it has to be a decision that you make for yourself. And this is the thing I would say. You might not be having any bad experiences online. You might not be experiencing cyberbullying. You might not be, you know, there's not the predatory stuff, the grooming, all that sort of stuff. None of that might be happening, but you're still exercising what's called opportunity cost. So it's not about what you're doing online. It's about what you're not doing while you're online. So the average person spends 30 plus hours a week online. That's a full-time job. What else could you be doing with your time other than that? You know, in terms of bettering your life or creating friendships or meeting up with people or, you know, joining a choir, volunteering, whatever it might be that you do, the phone is stealing time. It is stealing our attention, and we hand it over without really thinking about it. Your attention is the most valuable commodity that you have. The best thing that I can give you is my attention. It's the most valuable. It's like giving you time. And if we can start to value our attention and see it as something important, then we'll feel motivated to kind of curtail our usage more, because we won't just hand it over as if it's valueless, you know?
Dr. Coleman, thank you so much for those pieces of advice, for sure, and for sharing all that advice with us in general this evening. And I'm sure we will catch up with you again on iRadio's group chat.
All the best.
This is iRadio's group chat. If you're talking about it,
we're talking about it
on iRadio.